This is episode 9 of the Nothing Human podcast, Three Powers of the Human Spirit, part 9, Three Powers, Faith, and Salvation.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast, a biblically informed think space for exploring and articulating all the ways we make or break sense of human experience. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. From my youngest days, I have been fascinated with categories of thought, those often unconscious filing mechanisms that invisibly populate our premises, direct our inquiries, and ordain our conclusions. Join me as we investigate and interrogate our assumptions in an effort to articulate a more cohesive understanding of human information within the superstructure of God's truth. Welcome back to the Nothing Human podcast. Today we're going to talk about faith and salvation and the nature of redemption and how all that relates to the three powers. And I think this is a really interesting topic, and I hope that you enjoy it and are edified by it. But before I do that, I want to thank all of you again for engaging with the podcast, asking questions on my website, and rating and reviewing the podcast on various different platforms. I've seen a lot of those, and I really appreciate all of your feedback and all of your encouragement. If you haven't done that, please go ahead and do that for me. I've really appreciated what I've heard so far, and it really helps to get the podcast out there and raise it up in the ratings and the algorithm and things like that. Also, I have a Patreon. If you want to support us directly, I already have 5 supporters. I really appreciate each one of you. And I also appreciate the way that you've engaged with me on that platform. And I'm going to try to continue to post things, particularly for you, so that you can continue to get value out of this. As I said, I'm trying to freely give, and I've really appreciated your willingness to freely give in return. So let's get into this. So how do the three powers of each human being interact with God for salvation? What is the nature of faith, that instrument of our connection to God's redemptive power? Well, first, we should consider what faith is in general, like in more general terms. And oftentimes when I'm talking to Christians about faith, I find that they don't really have a very good understanding of what it is practically. We have a lot of definitions and a lot of kind of Christianese phrases, but I'd really like to know, like, what is it? You know, I'm interested in fundamentally, what is it? What is it doing? And what's its nature? So I've come up with an idea concerning this that I think is helpful to me, and maybe it will be to you as well, that faith is the spiritual instrument granted by God for human communion with the Godhead. So it is like the conduit through which God's presence, character, love, and self-revelation travels from God to humankind. It's the connective tissue between God and humankind. So without faith then, which we learn from Ephesians is God's gift by his grace and on his terms, we have no fellowship with God, no access to him. Given that idea of faith in general, how does faith operate in terms of the three powers? And I want to reiterate this because I talked about faith a little bit in the episode on the intellect and even before then. And I want to reiterate that though faith is the central power of the intellect, that doesn't mean that faith is only or exclusively intellectual. It doesn't logically follow that if faith is the center of the intellect in terms of its power, that then the intellect would exhaust all the aspects of faith. That just doesn't follow. The intellect begins in faith. As Proverbs says, the fear or heeding reverence of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge and the beginning of wisdom. But that doesn't mean that wisdom and knowledge alone exhaust all the dimensions of the reverence of God. Certainly that fear, which both receives and obeys and loves God, would be more than only intellectual. So I need to be abundantly clear on that, and I'm going to talk even further about it. Because Protestants, especially, have fallen prey to this deception of bare intellectual faith. In the book, The New England Mind by Perry Miller, Miller talks about this specifically concerning the American forefathers of Protestantism, the Puritans. And he writes, quote, "Puritanism, for all its piety, for all its hunger and thirst after salvation, never doubted that the life of the elect was the life of reason, and so could never, in its earnest struggle for regeneration, let go its intellectual heritage. Men in the 17th century did not see the dangers ahead, the possibility that such descriptions of faith in terms of right reason and the rational rule of eupraxia could give rise to a naturalistic morality and the belief that education would achieve everything usually ascribed to grace, because they were convinced that theology would remain forever the norm of reason. End quote. And there's actually, during this time, a little after the Puritans, a little remembered, I mean, most people don't even know about it, but it was an offshoot of Puritanism called Sandemanianism that held as an explicit principle of faith that it was merely intellectual assent and nothing more. Meaning, Sandeman believed all that was necessary for salvation was a bare intellectual assent, that nothing more attended to a real or genuine faith. And so in 1812, I mean, a lot of people had problems with this, but in 1812, Andrew Fuller wrote against this particular sect of Puritanism. And what he wrote is, "The foundation of whatever is distinguishing in the system seems to relate to the nature of justifying faith. This, Mr. Sandeman, constantly represents as the bare belief of the bare truth, by which definition he intends, as it would seem, to exclude from it everything pertaining to the will and the affections, except as effects produced by it." Well, the problem, in my opinion, and, you know, Andrew Fuller and others and Jonathan Edwards and the rest of them regularly argued against this hyper-intellectualism of Puritanism and the offshoots of Puritanism. They actually didn't believe that it was a right reading of Puritan thought and theology. But you would be forgiven, especially if you read Puritan thought and theology and Calvin and the rest of it, you would be forgiven for thinking that a lot of the Puritan trajectory was at least in the direction of this rationalism. And that is what it produced. It largely produced rationalism. Even in Geneva, just a couple generations after Calvin, the leaders of the Geneva Academy there were fully and completely rationalist, and a lot of them had totally rejected most of the aspects of real religion, real Christian religion, and had adopted a vague deistic conception of a mechanical universe. And you can see that same thing in Unitarianism and other rational offshoots of Puritanism in New England that occurred. Again, you can't say there's no reason why that happened, why the Puritan idea ultimately devolved in that way. I wrote a whole article about it if you're interested. I talk a little bit about Sandemanianism in the article. I'll link to it in the show notes if you're interested in reading it. The problem, in my opinion, is that though most Protestants would reject this idea in principle, they often follow this heretical idea in practice, which in itself, it kind of proves the absurdity of faith in only the intellectual power, because quite evidently, one can't believe or assent to the doctrine that faith must be in the whole person, and then go ahead and live as if that faith had no impact on the rest of your life. So I hope we can all agree that faith must encompass more than mere intellectual belief. And certainly, historic Christian belief has held that faith is more than intellectual. So let's look and see. I've collected a few different statements from some authoritative documents in different Christian traditions. And the first one is the Roman Catholic tradition. In section 155 of the Roman Catholic Catechism, it says, quote, "In faith, the human intellect and will cooperate with divine grace. Believing is an act of the intellect assenting to the divine truth by command of the will moved by God through grace." For the Orthodox Church, I have drawn this from a book called The Orthodox Faith, written by proto-presbyter Thomas Hopko, and in volume one of that book, he writes, quote, "There are basically two aspects to faith. One might even say two meanings of faith. The first is faith in someone or something, faith as the recognition of these persons or things as real, true, genuine, and valuable. For example, faith in God, in Christ, in the Holy Trinity, in the Church. The second is faith in the sense of trust or reliance. For Christians, both types of faith are necessary. One must believe in certain things with mind, heart, and soul, and then live by them in the course of everyday life." So that's a little bit more broad, but still largely, I mean, he says faith is two aspects. So again, that's the same two aspects that you see in the Roman Catholic tradition of intellect and will. Now we'll look at the Reformed Protestant perspective, which I think has largely shaped other Protestant sects, and they would agree with this to one extent or another. Calvin, in section 3 of the Institutes, writes, quote, "Faith is a firm and certain knowledge of God's benevolence toward us, founded upon the truth of the freely given promise in Christ, both revealed to our minds and sealed upon our hearts through the Holy Spirit." And by defining faith very centrally as a knowledge, as a kind of knowledge, Calvin is almost limiting the idea of faith in the Protestant tradition even more so than the Catholic or Orthodox tradition, which talks about it in two aspects. And most Protestant sects have talked about it in only that one aspect, this idea of assent or belief, which we talked about earlier. And that is, to some extent, the natural outflow of Calvin's idea. Somewhat. I really want to push back on that a little bit. And I wrote an article about this that I would love if you read, because I'm not going to go into all the details of it here. But I think that the understanding of Calvin, even in his own day, was much more limited than Calvin's own perspective. I don't think when Calvin talks about religious knowledge that he's just talking about an intellectual knowledge. I think he still has a little bit of that biblical idea, which he even talks about a little bit here, sealed upon our hearts. What does that mean? What does it mean, the heart? What does he mean by that? And I think he's at least talking about the will and would still be matching up with, for the most part, the Catholic and Orthodox perspective. At the same time, he's emphasizing knowledge and the intellect, especially because of the needs of his time. He thought that the works orientation of the Catholic and even Orthodox Church had become corrupt, and that there needed to be some refocus of the overall Christian project toward the intellectual development of Christians. So he can be forgiven, I think. I totally do forgive him. And I also think that he was misunderstood and continues to be misunderstood. And I wrote a whole article about it. So I'll link to that also in the show notes. And that gives you a little bit of a better, deeper understanding of what Calvin was talking about when he talks about faith as a religious knowledge. So all these definitions, in my opinion, and I think they largely cover the broad Christian traditions concerning these, are true, I think, as far as they go. But I don't think they go quite far enough. And considering faith in two powers is at least an improvement over considering it in only one. But you'll notice in all of these various different definitions and conceptions of faith that that third aspect is missing, that the third power, the affections, is missing in any explicit sense from all of the various different Christian traditions concerning faith. And I think, as you probably can guess, that that is wrong and is a problem. But the definitions are true, I think, as far as they go. So let's talk a little bit about how the understanding of faith in at least two senses or two powers, as both the assent or belief of the intellect and the submission or trust of the will, I think helps to solve some of the doctrinal controversies between at least Paul and James in the scriptures. So having it in two and not just one is at least helpful for this. So let's go ahead and do a little bit of that work. I'm not going to assume here that you are familiar with the controversy of Paul and James in the scriptures. So I'm just going to go ahead and explain it to you. And if you already know about this, then maybe I'll explain some things that make it even worse than you thought it was. So in James 2:24, he basically says that a person is justified from works and not from faith alone. So he says that. In Romans 3:28, Paul says very explicitly that a person is justified by faith apart from works of law, or without the works of the law. So this really does seem like almost a direct contradiction. In fact, one might think that James is quoting from Paul and negating what Paul is saying. And he might be, because I would imagine that a lot of what Paul said concerning this, that a person is justified by faith apart from works, was used, as is obvious from the book of James, by a lot of people to justify themselves in not producing any of the fruits or works of righteousness or pursuing virtue in any way whatsoever. Basically, if I'm justified by faith apart from works, then why do anything? And that's the issue that James is trying to address. And he's probably addressing people who have heard Paul say these kinds of things and have misinterpreted what they actually mean. But one way or the other, it does seem like Paul is saying something and James is saying basically the opposite thing. And a lot of the Protestant reformers had a big issue with this, because this was a central contention that they were getting at, as we just heard from Calvin, concerning justification through faith, which is a knowledge and not a work. right? So it's a knowledge you receive from God and not a work that you do. And it's not based on a work that you do. Whereas a lot of the Catholics would have looked at James and said, actually, you know, faith apart from works is dead. And so what do these things mean? Well, I think it really helps, actually, to be able to look at this and say that James is focusing on the volitional or will-oriented aspect of faith, whereas Paul is really focusing on the intellectual aspect of faith. And I think that helps to distinguish really their points and why what they're saying is true, that what Paul is saying is true, but that he's focusing on one part of faith, and that what James says is true, but he's focusing on this will-oriented part of faith. And it's easiest to understand this by discerning the different parts of Abraham's story that Paul and James focus on, because they actually both refer to Genesis 15 and even quote from it when it says that Abraham believed in the Lord and God reckoned it to him as righteousness. So Paul quotes that, so does James. But there's a big difference in which part of Abraham's story Paul or James draw from most significantly. So in Genesis 15, what we're dealing with is Abraham has just heard the promises of God concerning Abraham's children and future. And Abraham, it says, believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness, meaning that Abraham truly believed what God said. And God said, that's good enough for me. I'm reckoning that belief, that assent, as righteousness. Now, this event, when Abraham heard and believed in Genesis 15, required no further action. Like, it's not even possible. It's not a matter of like, oh, well, action needs to come out. No, it's not possible to have any further action. That's simply to assent to God's words of promise and say, I believe that, in all sincerity, is all Abraham actually could do at that moment. There was nothing else for him to do at that moment. But later, in Genesis 22, a number of years later, God comes to Abraham and asks Abraham to sacrifice the promised son, Isaac. At that point, Abraham could not merely assent. He couldn't just say, oh yeah, I believe you, God. God had not given him a promise at that point, but a command. And Abraham's faith at that point required trust and obedience, not merely assent, not merely belief, but actually trust and obedience. So in Genesis 15, Abraham exercised faith in his intellect. In Genesis 22, Abraham exercises it in his will. Now, Paul, in Galatians 3 and in Romans 3 and other things like that, dealing with works, righteousness, and prejudice against the Gentiles, focuses on Abraham's intellectual faith in Genesis 15 to make the point that a genuine, real faith, which would produce salvation, can occur without any works, and therefore salvation cannot be dependent on works. A valid, solid, logical point. Now, James, on the other hand, focuses on Abraham's offering of Isaac in Genesis 22, making the point that the same intellectual faith in Abraham, though genuine, would have proved totally false if Abraham had not obeyed in Genesis 22. So it's the same faith. We're dealing with the same faith of Abraham in both places. But the faith of Genesis 15 expressed itself primarily in Abraham's intellect, but in Genesis 22, that same faith expressed itself in Abraham's will. Now, Paul and James were making different points about faith, so they focused on different aspects of Abraham's faith. And incidentally, Protestants, beginning with Luther, as we kind of said, have fully endorsed Paul's emphasis on intellectual faith, and they, you know, love Romans and Galatians and all of Paul's epistles, and Romans especially. If you've ever been in any kind of Reformed Protestant context, that Romans is definitely the book, right? But Luther actually, you know, the kind of sparker of the Reformation, famously rejected James altogether, like the book of James, mostly because of this text, this particular verse in James 2. And Luther didn't even include James in his first German translation of the Bible. He included it in later editions, but he refused to number the pages. So that guy, he's a character. Roman Catholics, of course, being more will-oriented theologically, have always embraced James. With his emphases. And so both of these aspects of faith are good and necessary. Like, that's what we really need to come to, is that both aspects of faith are good and necessary. There's not really a contradiction between these two. There's a difference of emphasis between the two, and neither of them can be completely exclusive. James wouldn't say that it's not important for you to assent to and believe the words of God. Obviously, he would say you should, and the way you prove that you have is by doing what God tells you to do. And, you know, most people, Calvin included and the rest of them, would say it's not good enough to assent and believe if you don't actually follow through on that. You haven't even truly assented and believed if, like Calvin said, these are just ideas floating around in your head. Calvin and the rest of the reformers were pretty concerned, actually, with the works of righteousness. They just wanted them to flow from a genuine faith and not be precursors to faith. Not say, oh, through my works or through this, I can gain favor and I can earn my salvation. They just wanted to make sure that wasn't what was being taught. It's unclear whether that was being taught in the Catholic Church entirely, but clearly, I mean, if you look at this particular segment of history in the Catholic Church, there were things that needed to be reformed. In fact, later Roman Catholics will agree with that and say there were obviously things that need to be reformed, and indulgences, for instance, are no longer sold, and there has been a greater emphasis on teaching people concerning the faith within the Roman Catholic Church, and even, you know, Pope Francis a few years ago thanking Luther on the 500th anniversary, 2017, thanking Luther for refocusing the emphasis of the church on the importance of the scriptures, which he then endorsed. I mean, even though Luther, as far as I know, is still excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church. So anyway, maybe they will address that in time, or maybe not. Luther's 95 theses wouldn't even need to be written right now. All the things he talked about in it have already been addressed. Now, he went on to talk about other things that will probably never be addressed within the Roman Catholic Church because they're more central dogmas. But nonetheless, what I'm saying is clearly there was a lot in that particular time period in the Roman Catholic Church that did actually need to be reformed, which is why the Reformation happened. Unfortunately, the emphases of the Reformation were so narrow in so many ways that a lot of the inheritors, like we talked about with Sandemanianism, things like that, and Puritans, have adopted only that exclusive emphasis and have not gone on to develop the other aspects of faith that actually are very important. But most Christian faith traditions have limited faith to a discussion of the intellect and the will. And this is simply not sufficient, in my opinion. Now, I'm coming up against a large portion of church tradition, so please forgive me, but I have thought quite a bit about these things and read quite extensively on these things, and I think that this is a serious problem. Considering a third aspect of faith, I think, is necessary, and it's that part of faith that concerns the affections. Surprise, surprise. So what is the affectional aspect of faith? Like, what would we say is the affectional aspect of faith? The affectional aspect of faith is praise or worship. So this is the passionate response of loving affection and the manifest apprehension of a perceived good. So we see this all over the place in the scriptures. Love rejoices in the truth. Love desires the good. Further, since love is the giving of self for the benefit of another, loving faith is the recognition of God's goodness in the long term, eternally, and not just in the short term. In other words, we imagine and we apprehend the goodness of God even when we do not feel it passionately in the moment. This is that part of faith that we call hope, the vision of some future good not presently felt, and it is an essential part of the affectional aspect of faith. You can find signs of this all throughout the scriptures, not the least of which is in the first and second greatest commandments, which, you know, commandments generally speaking refer to the will. But even here, what are the first and second greatest commandments? Love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself, meaning that the will cannot even complete obedience or achieve righteousness without the aspect of love, without love. And so the affections are even central to a great degree right there. And you see various different passages that connect to that all over the scriptures. But the one that I think really helps to focus our understanding on this aspect of faith, which is hope or love or worship, is particularly in Lamentations chapter 3, verses 21 through 38, which I will read in a moment. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the context of Lamentations. Lamentations was written by Jeremiah, and it was written around the time when Jerusalem was about to be destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. Now, if you got to put yourself a little bit in the shoes of Jeremiah, the prophet, who is inside Jerusalem when it is besieged and destroyed and barely escapes. And it is in this context, the total and complete dissolution, seemingly, of the promises of God, the total and complete rejection of the Israelites, the total loss, the total collapse, everything falling apart. I mean, if you read Lamentations, it is called Lamentations for a very good reason. It is aptly named. But at the center of this book, at the very climax of this book of Lamentations, Jeremiah writes these words, which eventually would come to be included in a famous hymn, "Great is Thy Faithfulness," which we read, we oftentimes don't think, well, this is actually quoting from the saddest book, pretty much, in the whole Bible. I mean, called Lamentations. Again, it's a full-on lament. But listen to these words. Very interesting how he organizes this aspect of faith towards the goodness of God and the hope in God's goodness, which you can see throughout the Psalms as well. But let's hear this. "This I recall to my mind." Again, this mind, heart. "This I recall to my heart, therefore I have hope. The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul, therefore I have hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. It is good that he waits silently for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he should bear the yoke in his youth. Let him sit alone and be silent, since he has laid it on him. Let him put his mouth in the dust. Perhaps there is hope. Let him give his cheek to the smiter. Let him be filled with reproach. For the Lord will not reject forever. For if he causes grief, then he will have compassion, according to his abundant loving kindness. For he does not afflict willingly or grieve the sons of men, to crush under his feet all the prisoners of the land, to deprive a man of justice in the presence of the Most High, to defraud a man in his lawsuit. Of these things the Lord does not approve. Who is there who speaks and it comes to pass, unless the Lord has commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both good and evil go forth?" So I love that passage. And again, such a fascinating passage of hope and longing and of a pursuit of good. Did you notice how much good is talked about? The idea of it is good, it is good, this is good. Is it not from the Lord that both good and evil go forth? When we talked about this in the episode on the will, it's really important to kind of retrain your ears. When he's saying good, he means materially and spiritually good, meaning that which leads to life and pleasure, not that which leads to death and destruction. And you're talking about a man who witnessed with his eyes the total collapse, seemingly, of all of God's promises in the destruction of Jerusalem. He saw that with his eyes, and he wrote these words. Now, that is a man whose affections are fully engaged in faith. He is using that aspect of faith, which is hope, which is truly affectional, concerning the future good, even the present good of God, even in the face of this great evil and calamity and destruction. And it's only through that aspect of faith that he could hold on. It's not through any other aspect of faith. Because again, what he can see, what he seems to know even of what's happening in that moment, and what he can do, what he can trust in. I mean, all those things follow. But that first thing he really has to actually gain and maintain is hope. If he doesn't have hope, he's not going to have trust. He's not going to have true knowledge, that prophetic imagination we talked about, to see how things could be in spite of how they are. He's not going to have any of that unless first he can maintain hope. And maybe you're saying here, well, I thought hope was connected to the will. And certainly in terms of the perseverance to wait for that good, that is an action of the will, but it is served by the affections imagination of that perceived good, meaning that if the will is not informed by the affections that is a good and that it is a good worth waiting for, then hope is not going to be there. So I would say still that has to do with the affections serving the will. But to the affections in terms of faith, I would say praise or worship is a little bit more central. And the word worship we use it a lot, we don't necessarily think that its origins are this idea of worth-ship, meaning the ascribing of worth, and that is the ascribing of good to something. And that's obviously a work or a power of the affections that sometimes we call love. But in terms of God and the connection and communion with God, worship is that ascribing of value consciously to God, that he is good. Not just that good comes from him and we enjoy all the good things that he provides, but actually that he is himself good. This is mentioned in so many different scriptures, but even in Lamentations, you can see that that is what he says. He says to himself, "The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I have hope in him." You can see this spoken of also in the Psalms, where it says, "I have no good besides you," speaking to God. And also, that was the heart of the Levites, again, the priestly class, that priestly class, which was the master of the affections. The priestly class had no portion on the earth. It says explicitly the reason they didn't have an inheritance is that their inheritance was the Lord. Their portion was the Lord. Jeremiah was part of that priestly class, so he could say that not just as a believer, but even as a priest, meaning that he was this heart of the affections in the Israelite place. And that was meant to be exemplary for the rest of Israel, who would eventually become a kingdom of priests, that their portion would be in the Lord alone, and that faith, meaning that communion with God, would be that ascription of worth and good in God alone, that whom am I in heaven but you, and earth has nothing I desire but you. My flesh and my heart may fail. However, you are the strength of my heart and my portion forever. That is such a beautiful statement of the action of faith in the affections. So, I do believe then that you can clearly see these three aspects of faith working themselves out in the three powers. In the intellect, you have assent or belief. In the will, you have trust or hope as served by the affections. In the affections, you have this worship, this praise, this ascription of good that comes from a loving adoration of God as our only good. So those three aspects are really important. And I think that that third aspect really does need to be more fully emphasized inside the church, even in our catechisms, even in how we're talking about faith. We need to understand that faith does involve worship, praise, a joy in the goodness of God. And without that, I do not believe that we are full or complete as believers. So, if you're saved by faith, which, you know, that's spoken of in the scriptures pretty much constantly, are we saved then through the faith of the will, or the faith of the intellect, or the faith of the affections? And that's a little bit of a trick question, because you will almost certainly come to faith, if you do, first in your primary power. Meaning, if you are will-oriented, you will likely come to faith in God first through trust. If you are intellectually oriented, you will likely come to faith in God first through assent or belief, being convinced of the truth. If you are affectionally oriented, you will likely come to faith in God through an understanding of his goodness, sometimes expressed in the goodness of his people and represented on the earth through their works of charity, grace, and love. And these three things then, it doesn't really matter which one comes first, does it? If you are meeting God because of trust, then that is still can be genuine faith. If you are meeting with and communing with God through a genuine love of God and his goodness, then that could be genuine faith. Or if you're meeting or communing with him because you believe him and you believe in the truth of him, then that also could be genuine. But I don't think it will stay there. So how you come to faith in the first place through your primary power is almost certainly not going to be the last word in your development of faith and in your development as a believer. So once connected in fellowship to God, of course, you will most certainly learn to fellowship with God in all of his spiritual aspects and person and Godhead and other people also in your other powers as well. So especially if one of your powers has been abused, that process of becoming more like God in that power will almost certainly require that you focus on lifting up, rehabilitating, and making whole that abused power through faith, either in trust, belief, or hopeful love and worship. If you want to grow as a Christian, obviously you should want to grow as a Christian. Growth, sanctification, is God's will for you. So growing in faith is God's will for you. That's what he wants you to be doing, is to grow. You're probably more likely to choose a church whose primary power matches your own. And part of this is our misunderstanding of what our place is in the church, which has been very, I think, confused by modern ideas of business and commodities. We tend to think of the church as a distributor of religious or spiritual commodities that then we pay for in our tithes or pay for in support or in attendance. And in that way, we look for churches that we think will serve us. And typically, if we're looking for a church that will serve us, we're not thinking, serve me in my weakness, but rather serve me in my strength, confirm me, affirm me, make me feel good about myself. And it's not going to make you feel good about yourself if you're being served in your subject power, because you don't consider your subject power to be anything more than probably a liability or an embarrassment, especially if you've been abusing or dismissing that power. So if you're looking to be served and affirmed in a church rather than to grow in a church, you're probably going to pick a church that matches with your primary power, and then that church is going to be filled with people who are filled with that same primary power, and they're going to tend to abuse people in that church who don't have that primary power, or at least to treat those people like they're not as important in that particular community. You've probably experienced this already. So what you really should be thinking of is, how can I be a part of the church? How can I serve the church? How can I grow in the church? If you're thinking at all of how the church can serve you, you should be thinking, how can it serve me in growth, in sanctification, to lift up and help me rehabilitate these subject powers and even these partner powers that I haven't really invested in to the same degree? But you should also be thinking, if you go to a church that has that same primary power as yours, you may not even be in a place where you can serve that church all that well. They may already have what they need there in terms of that primary power already being invested in, already being cultivated, already being considered. So I think it is really important then to choose a church where you can serve and choose a church where you can grow. So it might be that when you go to choose a church that you can really invest in, that you can really be a part of, that you should be thinking, can I help this church and contribute to this church and the rehabilitation and growth of their subject power? Which might mean that you're going to a church whose primary power is not your own. And they, you know, there might be some resistance there. But at the same time, what that means is, one of the ways you can gain a hearing for the investment of your primary power is to allow that church in its primary power to teach and sanctify and help you in the areas where you are weak. So you go in first not saying, hey, how can I do some stuff here that you guys really need because you're a bunch of weaklings in this particular area, because that's not going to go over very well. So this is my rule that I generally give to people, which is that you should submit yourself to the superiority of others in those areas where you are weak and they are strong. And you should submit yourself to the benefit of others in the areas where they are weak and you are strong. In both cases, you should be submitting yourself to the value of other people and to the benefit of other people in love. So one last note in terms of salvation. That means that when we are appealing to people who may not believe in Jesus, we really do need to be more considerate of their primary powers. Consider, what is it that they value? And therefore, what is it that they need? If they are affectional and you are preaching at them the truth and giving them a bunch of rules, you're going to be talking past them. They're not going to hear you. And instead, it may be that the church needs to deal with affectional people in affectional ways. So if you have an affectional audience, why not show them something beautiful and good so that they can taste and see that the Lord is good? And if you're talking to an audience that's interested in truth and interested in ideas, well, then present to them the truth of God and the ideas of God, and apologetics might be really helpful in that particular arena. Or if you're dealing with people who are about trust, who are about the will, show them the practical effectiveness of the Christian life in producing what is right and in producing what works in the world. And I don't really think that the church right now, and possibly this is because of a lack of self-consciousness and self-awareness about these things, but I don't think we're really attempting to address the needs of the culture in ways that the culture actually could receive. And I think that's a major problem. If faith can come and communion with God can come in any of the three powers, then why not give your message, your gospel, the best possible chance of being received? If you're talking to an affectional person, give them the gospel of good. If you're talking to a will-oriented person, give them the gospel of righteousness. If you're talking to an intellectual person, give them the gospel of truth. And I think that what you'll find is you'll have far more success, for one, in addressing unbelief in other people. I also think that you will find, even if you don't have success, that at the very least, you'll be talking to and with a person and actually hearing and knowing them rather than just talking past them or talking at them. And so go out there and see what you can do with that and get back to me. Write me a comment if you have any questions, anything like that. I'm here for you guys and gals. And I'm really thankful to you also for listening and for engaging. Really appreciate it. Until next time.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien.